Hello everyone and welcome to the Association of Affiliate Cricket Podcast. I'm Russell Dignam and I'm joined as always by Cricket Europe's Andrew Dixon. Hi Andrew.
Hi Russell, everybody.
For logistical reasons, the show today is split in three parts. The first is news from 2 weeks ago. The second is an interview with Jan Bartosik of the Czech Republic. And we'll finish with some more recent news. News coming out of Oman Cricket this week, Andrew, that there's a bit of fallout from the World Cricket League Division 3 because of the lack of national players playing in their first division, and that also that the Omani national players didn't bother to even attend the trials because they were feel that they weren't given a fair run by the national board.
Yeah, this has been a common sort of theme in Omani cricket over the last few years. So since they sort of played in the ICC Trophy in 2005. The sort of local Omani national players feel that they're not getting the same opportunities as the expatriate community, which is to some extent something that happens across the region, the Gulf region. But so it's not surprising this has happened. I think the local Omani players actually went on strike a couple of years ago and refused to play any club cricket, never mind try out for the national team. And it's something that the Omani Cricket Board needs to resolve if they're going to stay as highly ranked as they have been in recent years. Obviously, they've dropped down to WCL4 now from being in WCL2 a few years back. So this is obviously having an effect on the team.
And there's some stadium news going about. Bermuda has put forward a proposal to host one-day international matches. Do you think they'll get much from that?
Well, they tried to get the national stadium approved to host ODIs back when they had ODI status a few years back. And I think the ICC pitch inspector, Andy Atkinson, I think his name is, went out and said that the pitch wasn't even suitable for growing tomatoes. So obviously he wasn't impressed by it, but by all accounts it's a lot better now. They've imported grass seeds from elsewhere, which is sort of ironic because a lot of cricket pitches in England are seeded with Bermuda grass, but Bermuda seems to have to import their grass from elsewhere to get a quality pitch. And by all accounts, it's a lot higher quality of a pitch now, and the facilities there are certainly ODI standards. They're better than a lot of facilities in some associate countries. And Bermuda is a country where cricket is part of the culture. Hopefully they can have a bigger audience for matches than perhaps a stadium in Florida, which, as we've already discussed on a previous episode, may not exist very shortly.
Also national stadium news, slightly worrying news that in Gibraltar, that because they've been given full status by UEFA, a decision that's very good for Gibraltar, because we always support the underdogs, that the plan is to build a 6,000-seat stadium where in pretty much the only place that they're currently able to play cricket, and they may struggle to find a place to play.
Yeah, it could be potentially disappointing. Hopefully some ground-sharing agreement can be come to. It happens in the Caribbean a lot. I know in Antigua, the Antigua football team plays at the ground they use for their test matches in Antigua. So football and cricket ground-sharing isn't completely out of the question, but if they have to build a certain capacity, space is very limited in Gibraltar. It's a very small area, and the cricket, you know, could lose out. And cricket is a high-profile sport in Gibraltar, and it'd be disappointing if they lost their main facility. They don't have many quality cricket facilities, and that is the only one. I think the other ones are, I think there's another ground that's sort of very low quality, not really suitable for developing the game. And it'd be a shame if you lose this one because of football.
This actually comes back to the Bermuda thing as well, in the sense that cricket, because cricket is, there's almost no chance that they'll be able to host a high-profile team in Gibraltar, a high-profile cricketing team, whereas they need that stadium for football to host one of the top 10 teams in the world probably every couple of years in terms of World Cup and UEFA qualifying. So if it becomes a battle between which sport's going to get it, cricket's going to be in a really difficult position there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Gibraltar occasionally get tours from English clubs, and they have had county sides play there in the past, but that's not going to sustain a ground in the face of potentially playing against, you know, let's say England or Scotland or, you know, France or whoever in your European Championship qualifying. It's just not going to compete.
There's some tours going on, tours planned. Philippines is going to tour the Hong Kong, which is good to see.
Yeah, it's... You know, obviously the top associate sides often expect full members to host them for tours, and it's good to see that the top associates will host the lower ranked associate and affiliate members for tours. In the same regard, and a few years ago, Island A played a couple of matches against Croatia, and this is along similar lines. Hong Kong, obviously not as strong as Ireland, but will put up a good contest for the Philippines.
And there's some one days that went on in the last week. Scotland played Pakistan. The second game was washed out. And the first game, fairly disappointing loss.
Yeah, and at one point Scotland were doing sort of reasonably well, but unfortunately they couldn't quite pull it off. I know I was saying on Twitter that it was looking like an upset was on the cards, but you know, it wasn't to be. A couple of players sort of played quite well. Majid Haq bowled well, taking 3 wickets, became Scotland's leading ODI wicket taker. Cal Kurtz got off to a reasonably good start, scored 32 opening the batting in his first match as captain, but in the end it wasn't enough. And I think after the game, I think Majid Haq said that had Ireland been set a target of 232, they'd have gone out there expecting to win. And Scotland just don't have that level of confidence.
Yeah, it can't be helping either that they have lost again in the Yorkshire Bank 40 competition against Essex this time.
So, yeah, another loss for Scotland in that tournament. Again, just a couple of players played well. Preston Momsen, 70 not out. Freddie Coleman, 64. Very different side than the ODI team. They don't have their county players involved with this. And even Neil Carter, which surprises me. Neil Carter's only playing club cricket in England. He's not playing with a county anymore. So I'm surprised they haven't got him to join their YB40 team. But you know, the likes of Ian Wardlaw obviously will be playing for Yorkshire. And so it's a much weaker team. They lost by 59 runs in a reduced game. And it's disappointing that you have those two players who play well and the rest of the team just don't join in. It's something we see quite a lot with associate sides playing against sort of domestic sides in full member countries.
While we're on the subject of teams playing county games or county clubs, Guernsey had a couple of games against the Sussex second 11 and likewise struggled to make any impact.
Yeah, very disappointing for Guernsey. I know they have a sort of a relationship with Sussex where they share some coaching facilities. I think last time they played Sussex, Academy a couple of years ago and put up a much better fight, but this time they were completely outclassed. Should also add there was some associate interest in the Sussex side. Michael Rippon, the recent Dutch international, was playing for them, and Amjad Khan, formerly of Denmark, then of England, then of one Test and one ODI for England, but is now re-eligible to play for Denmark, and there's rumours he may sort of show up in the European Championship this year. I hope those rumours are true. Denmark certainly need a bowler of his quality. It's disappointing for him that he didn't have a long England career, but good for associate cricket that he could be back for Denmark.
Yeah, that would definitely significantly improve their chances of getting through that tournament, but also perhaps at the end of the year, getting towards the World 2020 as well.
Yeah, definitely. And if they get there, a bowler of that quality could perhaps help, if not upset a team, but sort of compete with them.
We talked last week about what we might want to get out of the associate games against Pakistan. And I think the Ireland versus Pakistan game that has been concluded is probably almost exactly what you'd like. It wasn't an Ireland win, but it was a very close, exciting tie.
Yeah, it's almost what you want out of any one-day international. If only every one-day international was like this one. It was a thrilling game. I managed to watch most of it on the Quipu TV stream, which, again, is good for associate cricket. It's getting this high-profile thing. And Pakistan scored 266, Hafiz scoring quite a fantastic century, which was a real pleasure to watch. Then Ireland had a Duckworth Lewis target adjusted to 276. Paul Sterling, second consecutive century against Pakistan. I think his average against Pakistan must be something like a Don Bradman style average. He seems to play so well against them. And then Kevin O'Brien, I think this is his first half century since that World Cup win against England a couple of years ago. And he's got 84 or 47 balls. Got to the last ball. It was a case where your six would have won the game and a four tied the game. And it was a four. And, you know, very exciting game, thrilling climax, and a good advert, and not just for Irish cricket, but for cricket in general.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those games are part of the process of bringing fans to games for Ireland, and so to have one of the high-profile fixture be extremely close is obviously good. Hopefully the next game will be as good. The worst possible case scenario is, I guess, to have a really high-profile fixture that's followed in by the biggest dud when everyone comes to watch it based on what they heard about the first one.
Yeah, then the game on Sunday is a sellout. I'll be there, fortunately. Looking forward to it. Hopefully it'll be another exciting game. And hopefully Ireland can win it and, you know, secure the series. And I think they've got a good chance.
There was a couple of articles written after that match that Ireland deserves test status. It's something you disagree with, the idea that status should have it exist at all. Some sports have it at some level. Rugby union has slightly different levels of status, at least at their voting. FIFA doesn't have it at all, but they're not necessarily the best example of governance. Tell me why status shouldn't exist.
Yeah, just to speak about rugby union there, they have different status when it comes to members, but not when it comes to internationals. The media will talk about test matches in rugby union, but the International Rugby Board only actually defines internationals. And then the different national governing bodies will define what is a test match according to essentially a subset of these are our most important internationals. There are plenty of matches in rugby union and in rugby league, for that matter, where one side regards it as a test match and the other side doesn't. One side will list it on their website as part of their test matches, and you'll go to the other country's website and it won't be there. And to some extent, I have nothing too much against status when it comes to membership within an organisation, but it's the actual status of the matches that I have a problem with. It means that some performances can be sort of discounted. It means that these are the minnows, you know, they're not as important. It's historical reasons. The fact that one level of status has the word class in probably indicates its origin. It's designed to, you know, keep the unwashed masses away. I don't see that there's any harm done by opening up the game so that there is no status, that a match is just a match, an international is just an international. This is how pretty much every other sport is organised. And I don't see the harm by what harm would be done if cricket did that as well. Obviously, you'd have some criteria behind what can count as an international. The ground has to be a certain quality. It would have to be a turf pitch, for example. The facilities would have to be a certain standard. The players would have to be picked according to certain rules. Kenya play a 5-day game against Namibia. What's the harm in calling it a test match?
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. And I think if you look historically, there are actually a number of games in the test record that wouldn't have that status. There are games where England, a very famous game where England was playing in two places at the same time, which with their second and third 11, which really shouldn't be considered a test match.
Yeah, and there's also matches played on artificial wickets rather than turf wickets. Certainly South Africa's first couple of dozen matches and Pakistan's first few. You've got matches of 4 days duration, 3 days duration, 7 days duration, timeless matches, matches with 6 ball overs, 5 ball overs, 8 ball overs. Then that's before we even get to the first class record book, which has your matches like smokers versus non-smokers and players whose surname begins with B versus the rest of England, and you know, matches where you're 18 players 12 and it counts as first class still to this day. matches, you know, like six gentlemen and five players versus four gentlemen and seven players. You know, the people talk about the sanctity of the record book, and the record book's a bit of a joke, really. And there's matches that were regarded as tests at the time that have that now aren't regarded as tests. 100 years ago, Australia toured North America, played two first-class matches against a combined US and Canada side that at the time was reported in Australia as a test match. More recently, in 1970, after a South Africa tour of England was cancelled, a rest of the world team toured England, and those matches were recorded as test matches. The Test and County Cricket Board at the time gave out test caps to the players. One player played in those matches and never played for England again. So he has a test cap, even though he's actually played, as far as the ICC are concerned, zero test matches. I have a family friend who played in a five-day game for Nigeria against Ghana in the, I think, either 50s or the 60s. I can't remember quite when. But as far as he was concerned, he'd played in a test match. It was advertised in the local media at the time as a test match. I don't see there's any problem with calling it a test match. They're just international matches. And when it comes to the sort of record book, if, you know, someone does end up averaging more than Don Bradman or making a higher score than Lara, that doesn't necessarily mean they're the best. You know, when Hayden had his 380 against Zimbabwe, nobody actually thought that was the best innings of all time in Test cricket. So, you know, what's the harm?
I guess the biggest issue is that they really do need to separate the difference between the status of matches and the status of the nations. That's probably the biggest barrier to this being a thing, because obviously Czech cricket is not suited to running and having the same level of influence on the ICC as any of the major nations, because they are so small. But at the same time, they should be allowed to play a test match if they have the quality of player and the quality of and they were willing to play that format.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this is what other sports do. And I mean, rugby league is probably a better example than rugby union, because rugby league has affiliate members and full members, but every team can play full internationals. And in that sport as well, the criteria for full members are clearly defined. And if you meet those criteria, then the other full members cannot stop you from becoming a full member. They can only vote no to your full membership application if they can show you don't meet the criteria. And then if you cease to meet the criteria, you'll be kicked out of full membership. Russia was a full member of the Rugby League International Federation up until a few years ago, stopped meeting the criteria, and they were kicked out. But there's no way of the full member, if a full member fails to meet the criteria, then they do not get kicked out. It's, you know, one of the criteria for full membership, you know, if this document is actually a real document on the ICC website, is that you are entirely self-sufficient, that you are not reliable on ICC funding or sources from other countries, that within your country you are self-sufficient. And you could argue that the majority of full members are not self-sufficient. Probably only India, England and Australia could claim to be self-sufficient. The other countries rely on ICC funding or on money gained from Indian tours.
Yeah, which is itself an ICC, part of the ICC Future Tours program, that if they have to be, if those tours stop for some reason, it's almost certain that they have to close down the professionalism, professional part of their first-class program. They probably still have first-class cricket, but it wouldn't be professional in a lot of these countries. And conversely, if Ireland was given an Indian tour every 4 years, I suspect that they would be almost as rich as many of the other nations already. So it's a strange set of criteria, that one.
Yeah, and as I sort of said there, I don't think the criteria document is a real document. I think there's other criteria, which probably involves, you know, voting the right way and things like that. Obviously, I think the joke was that when India cancelled their tour in Zimbabwe, that maybe Zimbabwe didn't vote the right way recently. And there's probably a degree of truth to that.
I think we wouldn't find, we won't find out whether that's a real document until Ireland or someone takes the ICC to the CAS, as Gibraltar had to do to UEFA, to actually force them to lay out their criteria and prove that this is actually a proper vote and not just a cartel telling people what to do.
Yeah, and the ICC have been taken to the Court of Arbitration for Sport in the past. I know Italy took them there over the player eligibility criteria when they were prevented from picking Joe Scuderi in the 2001 ICC Trophy. Obviously, Joe Scuderi is an Italian citizen. Obviously, born and brought up in Australia, but an Italian citizen. And they felt that he should be able to play for them. And I think that's quite, to some extent, correct. And the ICC were taken to court because their eligibility criteria at the time was based on birth and residence. And so Cricket Italia took the ICC to the CAS and won their case. So I've often said that the only way that the ICC are going to become a more open organisation is if they have legal action taken against them. So if Ireland can meet the criteria on this document and can show they can meet the criteria and then they are prevented from becoming a full member, then Ireland would probably have a case for taking them to that Court of Arbitration for Sport. And that could open up a whole can of worms that maybe the ICC don't want opened. I heard a rumour, and this is only a rumour, I don't know how true this is, that when the World Cup was originally restricted to just the 10 full members, that Ireland and some of the other associates received legal advice that if he was taken to court, the Court of Arbitration for Sport, the ICC would not have a leg to stand on. And the ICC didn't want that taken to that court because it could have opened up that, you know, proverbial can of worms.
I must admit that I'm a little disappointed it didn't go to court.
So am I.
I guess today's Jan Bartosik, player for the Prague Cricket Club, to talk to us about cricket in the Czech Republic and what it's like to be a native-born player of cricket. Welcome, Jan.
Hello, Russ.
Start by telling us a little bit about Czech cricket. How big is it and how many teams are there?
Well, Czech cricket is a small pond. There are, let's say, five stable teams, that is, teams that participate in the leagues. They're all located in Prague, in our capital. Plus, there are two new emerging teams in southern and eastern Bohemia. These teams are, it's more like university students' teams. So now we have like seven teams, I can say. But those two teams plays, university teams plays only friendlies. They don't participate in the leagues. Cricket is an absolutely marginal sport in our country and is strictly tied with the expat community in our capital. Each of the teams, I think, has one or two locals, like, signed up. And, for example, my team, the Prague Cricket Club, for this season, there are five active locals, including me, which is some sort of record. So basically, we can say there's like a dozen locals participating in like, playing leagues and stuff in our country.
And a junior program, are there many juniors going around?
Well, there is not a real junior program. There is a lot of work done with the juniors. We have three accredited ICC accredited coaches who do coaching at several high schools, where they have teams. And but it's more like doing an ad hoc events for juniors than having like ongoing competition. The thing is, there's one junior team that participates in our indoor league, which is held in winter, and they did really well in past two years, I think.
And the juniors, obviously, they're native to the Czech Republic, or are they sons of expats?
Well, I would say 50% of them are locals and 50% of them are expats, because naturally, a school that sort of is pro-cricket or enables cricket being taught to its students has to have some sort of expert connection. So it's mostly like these expert schools in Prague, where half of the kids are expats and half of the kids are like rich Czechs.
And what's the level of the awareness in the sport in the Czech Republic?
Well, honestly, most of the Czechs would mistake cricket with croquet, you know, the sport that's played with the hammers and you have these goals on the grass. So when we approach people, the best way, because baseball's been here for about 20 years. So when we're sort of like approaching people, trying to explain, we always use the parallel with baseball. So quite a few people knew baseball. It's quite a developed sport. It's a small sport, but still much bigger than cricket. So it helps us. Baseball helps us. But generally, people know nothing about cricket.
I gather then that there's a very strong American influence in terms of what people know about, apart from football, other sports.
Well, our main sports are ice hockey, football, where we have a very good level of tennis, basketball, and this stuff. Also a floorball, if you know the indoor version of ice hockey. We don't have a sport like cricket. No, not really. It's really very difficult to sort of attract people or introduce people into cricket, like local people.
That's a good chance for you to tell us how you came to cricket then. How did you come across the sport and choose to take it up?
Well, it's a funny story. I'll try to make it as short as possible. In 2010, a friend of mine who studied sports management started working on his thesis. And one of the subtopics of his sports management thesis was corruption in sports. And because he doesn't speak English well, I did some Googling for him. So I entered the keywords corruption in sports. And like the fourth or fifth link that came out of Google was the scandal with the Pakistani bowlers Amir Asif and Butt playing England with bowling those no balls. So that was my first contact with cricket, and I sort of started following the link. And it got me to a BBC interview with Imran Khan, which really left me amazed. You know Imran Khan, refined gentleman, well-spoken. Compared to sports stars we are used to, like ice hockey players, football players who speak in simple sentences and are able of making a speech shorter than 2 minutes. Compared with Imran Khan, they look half retarded at best. And I thought, wow, this is like an ex-top player of his sport. This must be some super sport if it produces such a smart people. That's what I was thinking, and I sort of discovered cricket info, like BBC cricket, started following matches via the online, illegal online streams and stuff. And so basically that's how I got into cricket, through corruption.
I think most people consider that a very unusual way to come into cricket. What then inspired you to start playing the sport, because that's obviously an extra step ahead from just watching.
I read a lot about cricket, I follow a lot about cricket, I registered myself on some cricket forum on the web, and I sort of started to feel I'm doing a lot of e-cricket, you know, and that it may be good for change to try actually play. And it was like after half a year, several months, I sort of decided to join a club. I must also say that was my wife also told me, like, they're just sitting in front of a computer watching that silly cricket. Just go out and play it. That also played a role. So I applied for membership with a Prague cricket club and played my first match by the end of May 2011.
And in terms of playing, in terms of taking up a sport, it's obviously a lot of hurdles to overcome to take it up. How did you get about getting over some of those hurdles? What was the biggest ones?
The biggest one, because usually as training goes, you go into nets and you bowl to guys and you have like 10 minutes batting. So for me, the first thing was like actually to stay at the crease, you know, when some of the guys run at you and bowl like, even they bowl like slow, like 80 kilometers an hour or less, to stay at the crease and face the ball. That was the first thing, like, because I sort of wanted, you know, you just jump away from the crease. First 20, 30 deliveries I faced the urge to avoid the ball and go away from it. So this was the first thing. The other thing was probably bowling. You know, the bowling is probably the most unnatural action ever devised by mankind. It's very difficult from everything, like a local, a Czech person sporting experience, is about. It's very different. Even now, I'm just bowling very slow, very careful, and still have to, you know, control all my limbs to do the bowling action properly. So facing the ball, bowling, and the other thing I would like to mention is when I played my first match, I had some training, I talked to guys a lot about technique and stuff, but when I first came in the middle, you know, you tap your bat, and I turned my head around all these like 360 degrees. When you're batting in the net, it's such a small confined space. Everybody is a friend, talking, bowling. And then you walk into the middle and you just really have all this open space. Wow. I was really scared. Probably these three things were the most difficult for me.
And finding opportunities to actually get a chance, was the club very open to having a player, a native player come along? Sometimes this has been an issue in other countries.
The first game I got was because one of our bowlers got injured whilst bowling, and I was the only available guy around, so I just immediately jumped in a game. But generally there were and there are opportunities because, for example, it's Prague Cricket Club's policy to give everybody a game. It's a fair policy, and I don't think I've been skipped or omitted in playing. The fact is that I would say that 2010 and before, the clubs, all the Prague clubs, had sort of problems with getting 11 guys on Sunday, right? I would say that from 2011, lots of new guys joined my club and the other clubs, so there's been some sort of small renaissance of cricket, and there's been so many newcomers in past 2 years in my club that we fielded second 11 this season. To accommodate all the keen guys who want to play.
And is that 11 then offering opportunities that are not against the best players going around in Czech cricket? So you actually get a slightly easier standard?
No. We have a 40-over league and then we have a T20 league. We fielded the second team in the T20 league where we will play all the other clubs, right? Where we will play the best of the other clubs. There's not so many people yet to have like two level cricket. It's just we're a weaker team, but we play competitive cricket in T20 league.
And is this a problem for you and through, I guess, also attracting friends along, that it is so difficult a game to take up and that you have to play against the highest level in the league?
Well, yes, it's difficult, but I think there lies the beauty of cricket, because no matter what I learn, training, playing, there's always something new, something the opposition comes with, I have to face. I love this aspect of cricket. I'm learning all the time. And with attracting friends, it's bloody difficult. Because really, cricket is, I think it's related with the facilities. Because compared to some, I would say, like, average Australian city, there are, I would say, like, I don't know, cricket ovals. I don't mean, like, everywhere in the city, but there are cricket ovals, like, nets and facilities. So if an Australian is interested to bring a friend, he brings a friend, right, into nets or to watch a game. This quite doesn't work in here, because our new ground is at the outskirts of Prague, and it takes an hour from downtown to get there, and our facilities are sort of squeezed in the area where there is tennis school. So this is a bit difficult to bring friends, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the ground. It's got a turf pitch. What was the process of creating this?
Yeah. Basically, it's an agricultural land turned sporting or cricket field. It's the first and only cricket-only facility in our country. I think it took almost 2 years, and the main thing was to go all the bureaucracy, permits you need to have to play sport. So when the bureaucracy was over, the ICC helped us with, from the ICC fund, we bought the seats for the grass. I think it took half a year, and last April, that was the inaugural match at our new ground, and it's been successful. It's a great step forward for local cricketing community to have really something that's dedicated only to cricket. I mean, the process was generally saying, I would say it was quite easy. different thing would be if we decide to build like a proper cricket ground. That would take, I don't know, much, much more longer, many, many years.
And in terms of creating this pitch, was there a sufficient expertise to get this up and running?
Well, how to put it? This whole cricket ground project is more based on enthusiasm than expertise, right? Our groundsman is an English gentleman who is a lot into cricket, and he always dreamt about having a turf pitch. So now he has a turf pitch and he takes care of it. I don't know if he has any like groundsman knowledge or something, but he takes good care of the pitch.
Is that been used by all the clubs in Prague as well?
Yes, it's obviously the only ground, because clubs don't have enough money to develop a ground of their own.
And as a further question, that given that you've got so many clubs trying to use the ground, does that also mean there's a lot of clubs having to then find games elsewhere, or they're not having games every week because there are other people using it? Do you have to travel to nearby countries?
Actually, no. There's not so much cricket going on that we wouldn't like squeeze everything into the schedule. The schedule is quite busy with 40 over league, T20 league, and some friendlies. But we haven't got to the point where we would sort of be forced to play elsewhere. We only play because the Dresden Cricket Club in Germany takes part in our 40 over league, so we play some of the matches in Dresden. So that's the only occasion we are sort of like forced, or we have to play away from our home ground.
And that's a longish trip then?
Probably, as it's like 2 hours by car.
Which, again, I guess comes back to that bringing people into the game. That's quite a commitment to ask of people to take up not just their whole day, but also to travel really long distances.
Well, I mean, for me, this is another nice part of cricket. That if I go to play to Dresden, I usually stay overnight. I play other friendly the other day or something. I have a weekend with the guys away from my family. When I started, it was bothersome, you know, travel somewhere. But now, I take it as a positive. But yeah, I mean, just attracting new guys, going... It's a struggle, but we're not giving up.
Let's move on to the national team. They had previously fielded a team in several tournaments, but didn't go to the Division 3 tournament last year in Estonia.
Well, that was purely because of finance. We simply didn't... The cricket union simply didn't have enough money to send their team over there.
And... looking forward to this year, I think I read that they're looking to play some games against some opponents.
We were, actually, this year, I'm not sure, but I don't think we were planning on going anywhere. But we had a game scheduled in April against Hungary, like just basic friendly, 240 over games and 2 T20 games, but it was cancelled due to bad weather. So we're looking to reschedule the game, like, let's say later, like maybe August, September. Because last year our national team was in Hungary, and they played 4 games and it was a great success. Both our guys and the Hungarian guys like it a lot.
And the national team, obviously it's mostly expats. The native-born players aren't obviously coming through yet because there's so few of them.
Yeah, actually, there are 2 guys in the national team, 2 Czech guys, of course. But, you know, the national team business, it's a bit tricky one because there are quite strict rules. The ICC has set quite strict rules on who and when can represent certain country. And it's a bit confusing sometimes, but I think the ICC actually doesn't check it when it comes to an actual tournament. You know, so you can have like locals. You can have locals in the team. You can have experts who have been living in the country for past 7 years. Then you can have 2 experts who live in the country for past 4 years. So it's quite tricky to get the whole team together based on these rules if you want to make the team really competitive, right? But I'm not involved with anything that has to do with the national team. I only follow it.
The ICC, Czech Republic's quite an outpost for them, obviously. What's the relationship with them like, and what are the benefits of being part of that structure?
The benefits are obvious. That's the funding. Even though to some, let's say, cricket-playing countries or associate countries, the funding we get may look ridiculous. It's a huge amount of money for us, right? That's the main thing. Plus, through ICC, we got a few of our guys accredited as coaches, It's also a good thing. But generally, our relationship with ICC is a bit of a struggle because ICC has some rules for affiliate members. And some of the rules are pretty, I would say, strict, or I don't want to say nonsensical, but quite out of context. Because, for example, for an affiliate member, a country that has been an affiliate member for 3 years, there's a requirement that the country needs to have a full-time employee, that the cricket union needs to have a full-time employee, which, like, isn't a bad thing when you think about it. But put in local context, that is Czech Republic, we don't have enough money to pay a full-time employee. And second, such an employee wouldn't even have enough work to do. We don't have so much agenda that we would need a full-time employee to deal with it. So that's one of the things, right? We sort of were struggling with ICC because we just can't afford to have such an employee, right? The other important thing, interesting thing is like ICC requires to have a senior, junior, and women cricket. Well, we have a senior cricket, two leagues going on for many years. We have indoor league, but we don't have any like junior league, any regular tournament that's been taking place or with minimum. I think that ICC wants to have minimum 40, and there's which virtually no women cricket in our country. So these, for example, are two things we sort of had long discussions with ICC about.
Am I right in saying there was a suspension of the membership as a result of this?
Yeah, there was a couple of months we've been suspended because based on not fulfilling this criteria. But I think it seems the ICC guys looked at our country and the other affiliate countries in Middle and Eastern Europe and sort of became more flexible with it. So our membership, we are now again a full affiliate member.
And what would you hope from this? Do you need them to, you know, send people across to run school camps and actually do some of this groundwork since you don't have the resources to do what they want you to do? Or?
Well, I mean, their thinking is not wrong. It's what they want us to do is to have a structure. I mean, it's good, but I think the burden is on our side. We sort of need to make cricket more visible, more accessible to players, like to kids and adults and stuff like this. I think we need to really improve the way we are marketing cricket in our country. That's the most important thing, because if we don't do it, no matter how much money or what help we get from ICC, it will be fruitless, because it will be again targeted at the same 100 guys who have participated in Czech cricket for the last 10 years, right? Really, we need to sell cricket better in our country, and then we can benefit from what the ICC wants from its affiliate members.
That was all the questions I had, Jan. Did you have anything you wanted to throw in?
Definitely. I would like to invite anybody who's thinking about going to Europe and hasn't decided yet where to go exactly to come to our country, or anybody who's headed to Prague to get into contact with us. Because, you know, Prague is a beautiful city. We have the best beer in the world. It's cheaper than water, actually. Right? We have beautiful women. And we have a keen cricketing community that may use some help. So if anybody's going to Europe or going to Czech Republic, please get in touch. We'll get you game. We'll also definitely welcome guys who have some experience with coaching and stuff like this. So anybody who's into cricket and would like to play or would like to help is welcome.
That's certainly something that we can support, and hopefully people will get in touch. Jan, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Russ, for having me here. Bye.
One of the stories we've been tracking over the past couple of months has been the Fort Lauderdale Cricket Ground and the United States Australian Rules Football League put out a news article stating that they were putting in permanent goalposts on that ground as of last week, which could be good for cricket because it means at the very least it will remain an oval.
Yeah, indeed. Whether it will retain its grass wicket or not is an entirely different matter, though. I'm not really an expert on Aussie rules, but I assume that playing Aussie rules on a cricket field makes it a bit harder to maintain the wicket.
As a rule, it does. It can do a bit of damage. The seasons in Australia are separate. There's no overlap, so that you can get a pitch up over a few weeks after the end of the season. I'm not sure how that will affect the Florida pitch, but it is obviously a bit of a worry.
But having said that, it is the only sport pretty much that plays on an oval, so if they're going to share with someone, it's better than it being a baseball ground.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully they can continue playing cricket there.
Several big matches in the past few days. Ireland-Pakistan was one you attended. Another really exciting game, the second match.
Yeah, indeed it was. And in front of a packed house in great weather as well. I think there was, like you said, the official attendance was 3,500, which is great for Ireland. And fantastic weather for cricket. I even got sunburnt, which doesn't happen in this part of the world very often. And unfortunately, it wasn't the right result for Ireland. Another extremely close game, very exciting. Ed Joyce scored a fantastic century in the Ireland innings, reaching his century with a huge six, which almost went out of the ground. Obviously, no nervous 90s for Ed Joyce. And that was really the only significant contribution. Kevin O'Brien scored a 38, not as quickly as he usually scores. And then Pakistan got off to an awful start. They were, I think, 17 for 4 at one point. And Tim Murtagh and Trent Johnson both took a couple of wickets. Tim Murtagh, I think, it was his first wickets for Ireland. And Ireland were well on top for much of the game. And all of a sudden, Cameron Atkinson and Wahab Rees, numbers 8 and sort of 7 and 9, put on a partnership of almost 100 for the 8th wicket and took the game away from Ireland. I think it was Tim Murtagh's last over, went for 24, all scored by the number 9 batsman Wahab Riaz, and you shouldn't be letting a number 9 batsman take 20-odd off an over. And in the end, that was the difference, and Pakistan won by 2 wickets.
Was there a degree to which the Ireland kind of let Pakistan back in by not trying to follow up the maybe more experienced side or a side more accustomed to playing the big team would?
Yeah. They were, after that great opening spell by Murtagh and Johnson, they were missing another bowler, really. We'll come to this later in the episode, but someone often along the lines of Boyd Rankin was notable by his absence. They were let down a bit by some sloppy fielding. Not always. Kevin O'Brien took a great catch towards the end of the game and one of the best catches I've ever seen. Sort of diving full stretch, low to the ground, and a fantastic catch. But outside of that, there was just some sloppy fielding. They were letting ones turn into twos and misfielding a bit on the boundary. And it was the fielding that let them down. The batting was good, the bowling was good, but the fielding, not so good.
On the other hand, they've certainly given ample proof that at least at home they are competitive with most sides in world cricket.
Even maybe 4 years ago they would have probably lost both of these games quite handsomely. They've tied one and lost one with a very close one that they were well on top for much of the game. So this is a good sign. It's, to some extent, it's not how you play when you win, it's how you play when you lose. And Ireland have played well in defeat.
Let's talk about Boyd Rankin. He was named in the English squad for the remaining 2 1-days against New Zealand. It was just somewhat a surprise that he's actually been elevated to that level.
Yes, in the last 12 months, he's only actually played 4 1-day games for Warwickshire. No 2020s, just 4 1-day games. And, there was a lot of people ahead of him in the queue, we thought. Maybe Chris Tremlett or somebody like that. And it seems odd that he's been picked. And whether this is the influence of Ashley Giles, who was previously in charge at Warwickshire and now is the England 1-day coach, there have been a few Warwickshire players come up recently. Chris Wokes is another one. And all of them have seen pretty surprising selections. Chris Wokes sort of came out of nowhere. He wasn't really on the radar and all of a sudden was playing for England. Whether Boyd Rankin has been brought in for cover or to actually play will be an entirely different matter. I hope he doesn't play and will remain eligible for Ireland. But it's disappointing that this is now 3 Ireland players who will have played for England. Obviously, there's been a Danish player in recent years, and in previous years, Scottish players have played for England. In the past, though, Ireland and the other socialists didn't have the same profile that they do now. And it seems that the selection of Boyd Rankin has caused a lot more criticism of the ECB than the selections of Ed Joyce and Owen Morgan ever did.
Feedback on at least Twitter was quite negative, and in the press seems to be quite negative. So that's a positive sign for Ireland as well. People do actually seem to expect that they will, if not become a test nation, at least they deserve to have it considered, and that's obviously a lot more difficult if at least in theory, their best batsman and their best bowler aren't available to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was interesting that the ECB had obviously got some responses ready. They were giving the same response to a lot of people. So they were obviously expecting a lot of backlash over this. And I think they were perhaps surprised by the amount of backlash. It was coming from England fans as well as Ireland fans. A lot of people concerned, including myself, I am an England fan, that England aren't producing their own players. This is something we talk about with associate sides as well, not picking homegrown players. And England are doing the same. And this is obviously in the current England-New Zealand series, Luke Raunchy is playing for New Zealand, previously played for Australia. But New Zealand picking Luke Raunchy doesn't harm Australian cricket. Luke Raunchy is one player in a sea of a lot of top-class international players, whereas England picking Boyd Rankin actively harms Irish cricket.
So that obviously means that Boyd Rankin won't, if he does play, won't be eligible for the World Cup either, which was probably something that if Ireland, even though he'd said he'd retire, was maybe holding out the outside possibility of.
Yeah, I think there was a rumour that he was going to give it 2 years, and if not, he'd come back for Ireland in that World Cup. But obviously now, it could be a toss takes place, he's on the team sheet, and then it rains for the rest of the day, and he never plays. That makes him ineligible, because a toss counts as part of a game. And that would be a very cruel way to end his Ireland career. And I think it's perhaps unlikely that he will play for England again after this. I think he's coming to the side due to injury. As we said at the beginning, it's a surprising selection. I was thinking, cynical person that I am, that they'd wait to give him his debut in the ODI against Ireland in September, as they did with Ed Joyce a number of years ago, but obviously they're not going to do that. I think he probably would have played against Scotland last year had the England-Scotland ODI gone ahead. That was, I think, in the middle of England's test series at the time, so they would have been resting all their top players, and Boyd Rankin would probably have played in that. But it's just come completely out of the blue as a selection, and it's very unusual, and it's a shame for Irish cricket that they're losing another player.
Another level, it does at least put the reform of these eligibility things on the agenda, which is good. The ICC has very inconsistent rules depending on what level you're playing at, so this is something that really needs to be addressed.
Yeah, and there would have been nothing to stop Boyd Rankin having played in those Pakistan games and then playing in these New Zealand games for England, which is a very bizarre way of thinking. But if he wants to now go back to Ireland, he has to wait 4 years, and there's a distinct unfairness in that, and I suppose it's yet more evidence that the ICC protects the big boys rather than the little boys, and that's not what a sports governing body should be doing.
Yeah, the worry for me with the eligibility is if there was a requirement to wait 4 years after you played for an associate, but maybe some players would, if they had harbouring hopes of test status, of playing test matches, would hold from playing Ireland for Ireland.
This is something that happens in rugby league, where Ireland and Scotland and Wales now have the same status in international rugby league as England do, but England are still picking Scottish, Irish and to a lesser extent Welsh players. But rugby league again has a much more easier way of switching countries, in that they do it on a World Cup cycle. If you've played for a team in one World Cup cycle, you can then switch to another one. So if this was England's rugby league side selecting Boyd Rankin, after the next World Cup, he could then go back and play for Ireland. I'd rather have a situation where players played for one country and one country only. But perhaps that's unrealistic to expect, although other sports do it. And some cut-off point where you can go back and play for your original country, I think, would be useful. Or there's another option, which a couple of people have talked about in the past, of having separate eligibility rules for tests and for limited overs cricket. So a player could play for England in test matches, but remain eligible for Ireland in one-day internationals.
I think certainly where a player has already played for an associate, they should be able to switch back more easily. Obviously, as long as we're in this position where there's different statuses for different teams, it's going to be a real struggle to get them to not hold up that hope that they're going to get to play a higher status game. Like most other sports, if you look at football, that players generally move from strong sides to weaker sides rather than the opposite because they can play World Cup qualifiers and during the World Cup, even if some of them do miss out.
Yeah, and there's a long history of world-class players who are playing in the top leagues in Europe but are going back and playing for the national side. In history, to use an Irish example, would be George Best, who a world-class player who, because he played for Northern Ireland internationally, was never able to grace a World Cup. George Weah played for, I think, AC Milan in Italy and some other clubs in Europe, but went back to I think, Liberia, I think he played for internationally. Again, a very small country, but there was still the chance of them, however remote, of qualifying to play at the World Cup, the highest level of the game. But that doesn't exist in cricket. There's no way that Ireland can qualify to play a test match at the moment. It's hard to find a solution without completely changing the way the game's run. I, of course, think the way the game is run needs to completely be changed in the first place. It's unlikely to happen, but it's one of the things, something needs to be done. But what?
There was another associate match versus support member that finished yesterday. Slavia defeated Netherlands by 84 runs, fairly handily, but the Netherlands did all right, except really for the last six overs of the Slavia innings, where they somehow managed to concede 120 runs, which just is mind-boggling, that number.
Yeah, and I think potentially a record for the last six overs of a one-day international, and, you know, it was that JP Duminy innings, 150, I think it's his highest one-day international score, completely took the game away from them. And the Netherlands did quite well in reply. They scored, you know, 258, and they didn't fold as much as perhaps in the past they would. Erik Swazinski, very unlucky to miss out on a century, run out on 98. Very unfortunate way to be dismissed when you're in the 90s being run out. And then Peter Boren scored, just missed out on a 50, played very well as well. And, you know, disappointing for the Netherlands, but some progress. And again, we have to say, they were perhaps missing a couple of players in terms of Ryan Tendersgaarte and, to a lesser extent, maybe Alexi Kivese, who has done a Boyd Rankin and thrown his lot in with England.
Tim Vandergutten also wasn't playing. I'm not sure why, but he had been one of the better bowlers in the last year or so.
Yeah, I did hear that he had an injury. Michael Swarters also missed the game for an injury. I think he put a photo out on Twitter of a very nasty cut he'd got on his hand, which obviously had stopped him playing. I'm not sure what Tim Vandergutten's injury is, but obviously that, you know, him and perhaps Ryan Tendersgaarte could make a pretty decent bowling attack.
Yes, and when you can see 340, you definitely need a better bowling attack than what they could put out. Jersey has also played the MCC recently. They lost a 50-over contest by 2 wickets and won a 2020 with 2.5 overs to spare, which, again, credit to the MCC for organising a lot of matches against the various associate teams that are going to be playing in Europe this summer.
I've often said the MCC deserve a hell of a lot of credit for the work they do with associate countries. Obviously, they've previously toured, I think, the Cayman Islands this year, and they're going to be touring lots of other countries. We talked about the France tour recently. They're playing some matches in Ireland at the moment. I think they played at Irish universities the other day. I think they're going to play against the Ireland under-19s as well. And the MCC to some extent, do what the ICC should be doing in you're helping promote the game in these countries and giving the national sides a higher standard of player to play against. There'll often be a couple of county players in these MCC sides where they can get the availability, and it's good to see.
The other major tournament that they just finished is the ICC Africa Under-19s.
Not that you'd know about it looking at the ICC website.
Uganda, it was in Uganda, and Uganda Cricket has a few reports on it, so that it's a good place to go if you're interested in more depth. Namibia and Kenya were the best two teams reasonably easily. It's again a fairly uneven tournament, and Namibia won the final, I think, by 52 runs, so they'll be headed to the World Cup.
And I guess more evidence that Namibia are taking Kenya's place as the top associate nation in Africa. Disappointed for Kenya, they're now coached by your former player Steve Ticolo, but obviously his experience hasn't been enough to help Kenya overcome the Namibians and get to that Under-19 World Cup. Again, it's a shame that there's only one place for each region and there's no global qualifier again, which still strikes me as very odd.
There's one more region to go in the qualifiers there, which is the East Asia Pacific. I think that's at the end of the next month.
Europe to come as well in August.
So lots of cricket to look forward to at that level. Other cricket's coming up. The Ireland, it's a couple of weeks away that Ireland will be playing Australia, a very strong Australia, because it's essentially their Ashes bowling lineup preparing for that contest. So that'll again be a very good test.
Yeah, it's basically the Australia side minus the players playing in the Champions Trophy. So it's the test specialist to some extent, and it'd be a big match for Ireland, perhaps difficult to get their players available. I'm hoping that Ireland will have a reasonably strong side. I think there's only a few one-day games at the time, so maybe an agreement can be made with the counties to select some of the county professionals, with the perhaps an agreement where they'll play in this game and then Ireland won't pick them for the games against Scotland later in the year, because Ireland may have already qualified for the World Cup by then, so they can rest some players, experiment a bit, a bit of a deal, and get a stronger lineup to play against Australia. Good news that Cricket Ireland have decided to make the game free admission, so hopefully you'll have to get a good crowd and see what will be pretty close to Ireland v Australia Test match.
Yeah, it's certainly too. This is one of those games where if they are pushing for Test status, and they are, that they need to prove themselves in. So this is a really good opportunity for them to press that case.
Absolutely. And more of these games are needed. In the sort of half a dozen years Zimbabwe had away from Test cricket, they played quite a few of these games against the full member A sides. And I think if Ireland were given those same 6 years, you'd probably get a more competitive side than Zimbabwe out of it.
On that particular subject, there was an interesting thing from the ICC Cricket Committee, which is often roundly ignored, but the recommendation that Test match playing nations had to play at least 4 tests per year.
Yeah, it's a shame really that you have teams that are trying to avoid playing tests, but you've got teams that are absolutely desperate to play test matches but can't. So if you've got teams that don't want to play tests, why not replace them with the teams that actually do want to play tests? And it's something that we talk about a lot. Why not? What would be the harm by Ireland playing one test match? And to some extent as well, it's about bringing meaning into cricket. I'd rather have a team play one really meaningful test every 4 years than play 4 matches every year just to meet a quota. 4 completely pointless matches. A few people on Twitter told me that no test is ever pointless. I'd like to ask them that, after, England beat England, are leading 9-0 in the 10 matches and there's one test still to go, whether that test actually has any meaning at all. Or Australia leading 9-0, as the case may be.
Thank you.
whether that 10th match actually has a point to it. As I said, it strikes me as odd that you've got teams absolutely desperate to play test matches who can't, and teams that can play test matches who are desperate to avoid them.
It was one of the interesting points in the book report that I found in Congress at the time, that the suggestion that full members, the test data should be separated from full membership, not because the political thing should be separated from the merit-based thing, but because some teams shouldn't be forced to play test matches even if they've got full member status. It seems like one of the requirements of being a full member should be, at the very least, you should preserve test cricket.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of full members sort of aren't preserving test cricket. I often find myself pointing out that every argument people come up with for not giving Ireland test status also applies to at least one, possibly most, of the full members. Some of the full members play about as many tests as Ireland do.
On that note, Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you.